it's a great privilege to have something to say theologically, I think, in relation to the Darwin issue. And there have been times, I think, when the theology issue has been suppressed, especially by some professors known from this university. However, what I'm going to do today is I'm not going to tackle the particular thought of Richard Dawkins. Instead, I'm going to do something else, something that perhaps he hasn't even considered worth doing at all. And that is look at the relationship between Christ and evolution. Because the relationship between Christ and evolution has been not just marginalised, but ignored, not just by those in the scientific field, but those in the theological field as well. And I hope to outline why I think this may be the case in the course of today, but also suggest another way of thinking about that relationship, a way that doesn't, if you like, part company with Darwin's theories, and a way of thinking creatively, both theologically and biologically. I also think that to ignore the Christ question is to ignore the heart of the Christian faith. We can talk about God ad infinitum, but God is about theism, and it's about belief that's shared with a number of different Abrahamic faiths and other religious traditions, is not necessarily distinctive to Christianity. So if we're going to tackle the evolution question, the evolution in relation to Christianity, then I think we need to look at the Christ question as well. And that's the premise of the reason, one of the reasons why I tried to write this book, which you'll have, a synopsis of just one aspect of it in the lecture today. I'm not covering everything. I'm just covering one snippet of what I deal with in the book. And I have to admit, it was one of the hardest books I've ever written, so maybe that's why people have ignored this question, because it really is extremely difficult to tackle. But if in the course of today, I hope that you will follow my argument, and I will attempt, as it were, to lay out the steps that I have taken in the struggle that I have had to relate these two disparate areas. I'm going to refer, first of all, to the classic debates, very, very briefly, before moving on to thinking about the more liberal reactions where I would say encompass also those in the science and religion community to a large extent. And then I'm going to propose, the sound system has suddenly gone full volume. I'm going to propose an alternative based on theater drama. Historically, the conflict between evolution and Christianity has made out that we either end up with perhaps a friendship between the two, as Arthur Peacock was antagonized by the idea that it was just in terms of conflict. And he suggested that actually we should welcome Darwin's theory of evolution as a friend. And he said this for two reasons. First of all, he believed that those who portrayed it in terms of enmity were ignoring the fact that there were social factors as to why T.H. Huxley, for example, was particularly hostile towards ecclesial statements. And the reason he was hostile was because he believed that the church should not have control over biology. Now, this may seem like a rather quaint historical incident, in that today no one would dream of thinking that biology has any control, has any control over biology. But of course, in the climate in which Huxley and others were writing, the church had much greater political and social supremacy, and therefore their work was to some extent, or rather they believed their work was to some extent restricted. And this is, Peacock believes, is why there was this enmity. It wasn't necessarily anything to do with the inherent dissonance between the two areas. And he also suggests this, that the theory of evolution by natural selection allows us to go deeper into our understanding of what the incarnation really means, and deeper into our understanding of who God is, God understood as incarnate. God understood as sacramental presence in the world. Now, those who have become familiar with the latest vitriolic outpourings of Richard Dawkins might be forgiven for wondering just what kind of friend Darwin represents. But he is representative, as I say, of the enmity between the two, and he's highlighted what he considers are the core areas of dissonance and divergence. Of course, I believe that his own understanding of God is naive, and his own understanding of theology is particularly naive. But having said that, he, if you like, epitomizes the reaction by some biologists towards theological statements. I don't think it's the only reaction of biologists, but it is one person's reaction, and it's a reaction that is very deeply held by him. And I believe you have a debate coming up just this Thursday that shows that the conflict, as it were, to some extent, is still alive. Although, as I said, I'm not going to deal with that here, because I believe we need to go beyond these portrayals of friendship and enmity and look at something in a different kind of way. In other words, we need to find alternative ways forward that also include the Christ question, a question which Dawkins has ignored and Peacock only has really touched on relatively lightly in his writings. But to do that, we need to go back to understanding, well, what about the classic accounts of Christology? How has Christ been understood? And the human and divine nature, bringing those two ideas together in the Council of Chalcedon, in the Chalcedon definition of 451, if you like, epitomised a classical approach to the issue. It was, how do we combine both an understanding of Christ as human and an understanding of Christ as both as divine in a combined nature? Now, while the Alexandrian school emphasized the divinity of Christ in relation to that combination, the Antiochian school emphasized the humanity of Christ. They both tried to be faithful to the Chalcedon definition, however. Other debates, such as the anhypostasia and the enhypostasia, that is the human nature of Christ in the universal sense and the human nature of Christ in the particular sense, carried on in this particular realm of history. And you might be forgiven for wondering at this point, who are they speaking to? It certainly doesn't seem to be to the biological or the enlightened world, post-enlightenment thought world. Perichoresis is another idea where there is an understanding of Christ in terms of the Trinity, that is the Trinity of Father, Son, and Spirit. All these are, as it were, internal debates within theology. And these internal debates have dominated the account to such an extent that trying to situate those debates in relation to, say, science or scientific theories has been missed out. So it's quite understandable, therefore, that there have been reactions to the classic tradition, especially in those working in the science and religion community, in as much as they have dealt with the area of Christology, although, as I said before, actually tackling this in any detail hasn't really been done to any great extent. But in as much as Arthur Peacock devotes one chapter of his book on All That Is to a consideration of Christology, he claims this: that Jesus is the archetype or moral example. That's how we are to understand who Christ is. That God's character and love is displayed in the person of Christ. That Jesus appears as humanity made perfect. That Jesus is emergent divine reality. And finally, that Jesus' divinity relates to his perfect obedience. All these are relatively standard liberal interpretations of who Christ is, but they are liberal in as much as they do not demand very much of us in terms of recognizing Christ's divinity. Christ's divinity then relates to his perfect obedience, but that's all we can say about it. His divinity, if you like, is pushed a little bit to one side in these interpretations. And so as a result of the response to the Darwinian evolution, we find Christ's divinity soft pedaled, as it were, in order to accommodate the Darwinian story. Pico goes further than this and speaks of the naturalistic, what I would call a naturalistic Christ. Jesus is the manifestation of what, or rather of the one, who is already in the world, though not recognised or known. Now, I'm not trying to just knock down Peacock's thinking here, because I have Arthur Peacock was a friend of mine and someone I respect. But what I'm saying is I think that far more can be said than he says in this in relating Christ and evolution. It's above all counter the two natures classical Christology. And Ian Barber joins the fray, and he's another prominent figure in the science and religion dialogue. And he says this: although his book on religion and science only devotes about one page to consideration of Christology, he says this: what was unique about Christ, in other words, was his relationship with God, not his metaphysical substance, even though he had two wills. He was also able to exercise human freedom and personal responsibility. What I'm asking is there another way of treating this without committing the sin, as they see it, of the metaphysical substances? I'm not trying to go down that route, but maybe there's something missing here as well. Barber's spirit Christology draws heavily on Geoffrey Lamp's understanding of Christ as spirit-filled human being. He says this: Christ understood as spirit-filled a pattern of union between God as spirit and the spirit of humanity. It's in the spirit that we find that union between Christ and God. Christ becomes the model Adam, a new stage in evolution. We can ask ourselves now, well, what happens to redemption? If Christ is simply a stage in the evolutionary process, does that bring hope to humanity or to the rest of the evolved world? Or is it just one more stage in the overall process? Process thought is lurking at the background throughout this account. The newness of Christ is one of personal relationships, ideas, and the response of the community. The difference between Christ and other humans seems to be one of degree rather than anything more radical. It's very similar to Peacock's approach. Both affirm the human nature of Christ and interpret the divine nature just in terms of human characteristics. Now, I would agree with both Barber and Peacock that the humanity of Christ is akin to our own. In other words, I don't want to disagree with that aspect of their understanding. But I think that once we confine Christ's the understanding of Christ simply to that understanding of human nature, then something maybe is missing. Would I really worship Jesus as Lord if I had this view of Christology or not? Maybe I would, but I'm not sure. Barber's spirit Christology, then, is one which says that Christ is the distinctive but not exclusive revelation of the power of God. He goes further and says that Christ is God's supreme act. And Christ's uniqueness is the content of God's aims for him and his actualization of those aims. The thought of Christ as God incarnate, in some sense, God assuming human nature, seems to have disappeared from view entirely in this account. But echoing behind it, we find resonances with that great paleontologist and Jesuit theologian, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. But if we look at his particular understanding of Christ and evolution, about which he spoke in depth, he situates his own evolutionary view according to the progressive model of Herbert Spencer rather than the Darwinian account of natural selection. And I think this is of crucial importance, because if Christ is modelled as a new stage in evolution, which both Peacock and Barber seem to adhere to, then their model is actually closer to Spencer compared to Darwin, because it was only Spencer that believed in a progressive model of evolution. Teilhard took this further than either of them in situating Christ as somehow emancipated from time and space, rather than simply emerging from evolution. And this is one area where both Barbara and Peacock disagree with Teilhard de Chardin. But in Teilhard's view, Christ is at the crossroads where everything can be seen, can be felt, can be controlled, can be vitalized, can be in touch with everything else. Isn't that not an admirable place in which to position, or rather recognize, Christ? So he certainly doesn't weaken the place of Christ, but at the same time, he places the incarnation in an evolutionary perspective. Christ is also understood as the cosmic Christ, and he draws here on the thinking of the Eastern Orthodox tradition, but at the same time, Christ is then emancipated from time and space. So Christ is not just explained by evolution. In one of its aspects, different from that in which we are witnessing its formation, it has always been emerging above a world from which, seen from another angle, it is at the same time in the process of emergence. And that's his understanding of who Christ is. In Teilhard, the future impinges on the present, so that the future isn't simply coming out of the present in the way that process theology claims, but the future is somehow impinging on the present. And this is what renders the movement not only irreversible, but irresistible. In Teilhard's portrait, God is the prime psychic mover. Now, although he has elevated the role of Christ in his thinking between Christ and evolution, there are some severe problems in the way he has done this. And these are some of the issues which I take issue with in Teilhard de Chardin. First of all, his evolution is understood as progressive, and that in itself owes more to Herbert Spencer compared to Darwin. In addition, it also becomes metaphysical in a way that Darwinian theorists would object strongly to such a move, and so would Barbara and Peacock. His anthropocentrism in relation to the evolutionary account is also inaccurate, in that the course of evolutionary history isn't simply directed towards human beings. That is a mistake. Theologically, the tight association of Christ and evolution is problematic, in as much as it ties Christ into a particular understanding of evolution. So he ends up with a Christomonism, Christ becoming remote from the historical Jesus. In addition, there are other problems with his thinking, such as evil becomes somehow naturalized into the process as a whole, accepted because it's part of the evolutionary story. He is also very optimistic about science and human progress, and when the atomic bomb was dropped, he believed it was a positive move for humanity. And I don't want to go down that route, but in other words, there were ethical consequences for some of this way of thinking about things. That really is just a prolegomena for what I want to say next. That is an overview of thoughts which set the scene for what I'm trying to suggest next, and that is a new way of thinking about how to relate Christ and evolution. And the way that I found particularly helpful, and I came across it almost accidentally, but is through theodrama. And here the history of nature and the human history come together in a story, but not in a normal kind of story, because if we just tell the story in one particular way, then it develops what's known as grand narratives. And it's something that postmodern theorists have discussed for some time, where they want to resist this idea of grand narratives. And I would say that all cosmological accounts, accounts of evolution, accounts of natural selection, accounts of theology which ignore the particular and so on, are all grand narratives. Theodrama is an alternative reading of history from a theological perspective. It weaves together history and future hope in a theodrama, a drama that's concerned with God's purposes. But the first question we need to ask ourselves before we start on this rather bold enterprise is to say, are theology and history compatible? Can we really marry the two? Because history, of course, is also influenced by science in its modern scholarship. Ben Quash says this, that in theodrama, theologians are prepared to see the dense historical world as having an origin and an end in the creative purposing of God, a God who can relate personally to his creatures. People ready to acknowledge the idea that there can be a revelation, a prevenient ground for our knowledge and perception that is not the product of our knowledge and perception, which is neither accidental or impersonal, but which freely, even lovingly, communicates itself. And I'm drawing here on his book, Theology and the Drama of History. So, theodrama is prepared then to consider history and eschatology together. Drama is about human actions in particular contexts, so we might ask ourselves, well, how on earth can this then connect with evolution? But just bear with me because I'm getting to that next. Theodrama is about actions in relation to God's purposes, and there is a stress on human agency and context and plot. It is a dynamic story and a dynamic unfolding. It's not just an inevitable grand narrative that has one particular outcome, a kind of determinism that's there from the beginning. Rather, the emphasis is on subjects, the stage, and also action and the freedom of the human person to respond in particular ways, understood in relation to the freedom of God, the divine freedom. In other words, the divine freedom and human freedom are engaged in an encounter that resists making subjects or structures key to the interpretation of history. What I want to do next is to argue that we include evolution more explicitly in the theodrama. Evolved creatures become more than simply the stage on which human activity is played out. Darwin has taught us this, that nature is also historical. The common reading of history as genealogy or dynamics of historical change is also true in the evolutionary world. Evolutionary history, especially that according to evolutionary psychology, speaks like a grand narrative, a narrative, as it were, that is just in terms of a dynamic of historical change. Much the same is true for some interpretations of Darwin's theory of evolution. So both human accounts and evolutionary accounts become grand narratives. If we include evolution in the drama, then non-human creatures no longer become simply the backdrop of human activity, but they become part of our story. In human history, synchronic readings, that is readings which are interpreted in one particular way, fail to give due attention to the particulars, to the individuals, the exceptions to the rules, the resistances to explanation and the densities of meaning that ask for recognition in a good description of historical reality. And I believe that this critique can be extended also to biological reality, to evolutionary reality. So in order to do this, we need to imagine evolution also as drama. Of course, it encourages a close examination of some creatures and some scenes. We might want to particularly focus, for example, on the primates or on our early hominid ancestors. Maybe the canids, that is an understanding of canid communities, that's dogs or wolves or whatever, give us some understanding of the early social lives of human beings. And I've had a considerable dialogue with Mark Becker, who's written a number of interesting books on on the emotional lives of animals. And he's got a new one just coming out just in the next few weeks. I also think that by widening the drama, it takes account of the tragic in a way that a grand narrative fails to do. It resists then any generalization of evil, because it gets to the details of the particulars, while taking due account of contingency. And this is where, if you like, I side with authors like Stephen Jay Gould, with his stress on the contingent nature of the evolutionary process. But in order to fill out this account a little more, we need to look at how epic evolutionary psychology has become. If you look at any textbook on evolutionary psychology, it is written as if it's a grand narrative, a story, as it were, that betrays no possible alternatives, one where almost approaching genetic determinism. And I would say the same is true of Richard Dawkins' selfish gene. There is an inevitability there where there's no possibility of change, no possibility of contingency operating in a certain way to allow due account of its being an important factor in the overall process. It presumes we can be outside observers. And for the theological part of this account, I'm drawing particularly on the work of Hans Urs von Balthasar, a Roman Catholic theologian, who wrote a great trilogy of works. The first part of the trilogy were seven volumes called The Glory of the Lord, and the second part of his trilogy were five volumes of theodrama. This is where both Ben Quash and myself gain inspiration, as it were, for this thought on theodrama. And he argues against epic readings of theology, many of which he finds in the official statements of the church to which he belongs. And he says this, that they smooth out the folds and say that Jesus' suffering is past history. We can only speak of his continued suffering in an indirect sense, insofar as those who believe in him are referred to metaphorically as his members. So in other words, epic readings lead eventually, perhaps, to the genre of false objectification. And something is going on here which, if you like, restrains the living reality that we're encountering. Of course, there can be reactions to epic theology. In the lyric, which is the more mystical tradition, which is very often ignored by systematic theologians and others. And in lyric readings are individualistic and more common, as I said, in mystical interpretations. Here the whole substance of an action is transposed into a highly volatile, highly individual, immediate and emotionally coloured mode of response and expression. So what are we to do with these two seeming strands in theology, one the epic and one the lyric? Balthasar claims that one reaction to epic theology might be theopraxy. In other words, to go down the route of seeing things in more practical terms in relation to particular political or social issues of the day. But there is an alternative which is more systematic, and that is the theodrama, the action of God in history. The anticipation in theodrama doesn't lead to the kind of resignation that we get in an epic account. And behind his writing, we see the influence of Ignatius of Loyola, who allowed the positive attitude to the natural world, where God is found in all things. He also allowed a combination of lyric elements. In other words, theodrama is about a synthesis of the epic and lyric in some sense. It's them coming together in a new kind of way to avoid the problems associated with both. It opens a way for the inclusion of creation in the theodrama. And Balthasar, if you can bear with a long quotation, because writing as a German theologian, everything is, even one sentence is incredibly long. So he says this, "It so overarches everything from beginning to end that there is no standpoint from which we could observe and portray events as if we were uninvolved narrators of an epic. By wanting to find such an external standpoint, allegedly because it will enable us to evaluate the events objectively, We put ourselves outside the drama, which has already drawn all truth and objectivity into itself. In this play, all the spectators must eventually become fellow actors, whether they wish to or not. Now, how does this pan out when we're dealing with Christology? I believe it leads to what we might call a kenotic Christology, but it's not about a giving up of attributes of who Christ is, nor is it a focus on essences, so we don't need to go down that particular route in the classical tradition. But it is about a filial response that unites the human Jesus in the divine Son in a Trinitarian way. It's about the drama of the Son and the human Jesus coming together in a particular way, the drama of God and Christ, if understood it in his historical working out. Atonement is understood here in terms of the primacy of the kenotic love of the Trinity. So, and we could go on, it's inclusive here of sin, of creaturely being as such. Now, I can't go into all the different facets of what this kenotic Christology involves, because I want to weave in, towards the end of my lecture today, some evolutionary perspective, so that you know that this isn't an idea that necessarily just comes from a theological grid, as it were, but it also comes from evolutionary biologists themselves, who hint at much the same kind of thing, although they haven't worked it out in any detail. Jeffrey Slosh, who's an evolutionary biologist working in the US, he says this. He talks about the evolutionary account as a drama. He says the lines and the players and even the plot may change over the evolutionary time, though they are ever constrained by the props and setting and choreographic syntax of the ecological moment. He also takes the idea of evolution as a drama from Evelyn Hutchinson, but he doesn't take it any further than that. It just sort of sits there in the midst of his account and goes no further. But I think we can take it further, and I think it's very significant. First of all, the dramatic includes indeterminacy that we find in the evolutionary account. Performance allows the inclusion of other creatures. According to Slosh, the ideal and actualized niches in evolutionary history portray evolution as having, if you like, a direction. He talks about the ideal niche as heaven, although he does say that in actual terms the ideal is interpreted as optimal by most biologists rather than necessarily ideal. So he rejects developed teleology, that is a developed sense of the future progress. At the same time, he believes that there is no evidence for an increase in complexity, and there's no evidence for creatures becoming more mutualistic. In other words, you don't see in the evolutionary story a particular pattern of progress in the way that Teilhard de Chardin assumed, and also some other people assumed. So in other words, he believes that these patterns towards complexity and mutualism and so on, especially in some of the earliest creatures that we examine, it's not as clear-cut as we might think. Dawkins' extended phenotype beyond individual bodies he uses as an analogy for the resurrection. I find this analogy somewhat stretching, and I'm sure that Dawkins will be horrified that his ideas were being used in order to bolster an interpretation of the resurrection. I don't think it's particularly convincing or helpful. So in other words, while I agree with Slosh that that drama is an important way of thinking about the evolutionary account, I'm not sure whether his understanding of resurrection in terms of extended phenotype is all that helpful. He also notices that there are trends in evolution which are highly variable. For example, levels of organization have gone up over time. There's also been an increase in body size, but there's also an increase in competition between species. So in other words, there isn't this sort of progressive view that tends to be assumed when theologians get on to talk about evolutionary accounts. They tend to assume some sort of progress is happening, and that he believes that this is a mistake. I also think that you don't have to have that view if you think of this in terms of theodrama. He believes also that a critique of eschatology is based on evolutionary aesthetics, is that we have fashioned God after our own fallen image, precisely the cultural moment when theology needs to recall us in eschatological hope, the renewal of his moral image within us. What he's saying here is that those evolutionary eschatologies, and he's referring here to John Court's books on Darwin, Theology After Darwin and so on, those books tend to assume some sort of evolutionary aesthetics. And he believes that actually we've fashioned God after our own fallen image if we marry God too closely to this idea or ideal. I believe that theodrama counters that criticism because, of course, it takes a different tack entirely. And theodrama avoids the problem of simple endorsement of evolution. It gives due weight to Christ's significance without weakening the role of evolution itself. It provides a metaphor for how to think through Christology and evolution. And it challenges both theology and evolutionary theory. So those are the things it tries to do. How far it's going to be used, we'll have to wait and see, really, because this is as yet to be published. And just to give you an idea of the different chapters that I've used in this book, because I've only just touched on these aspects here, there are flies in the back. I start off in the first chapter from which this lecture is drawn, speaking about Christ and evolution as theodrama. Then I look critically at evolutionary psychology and talk about it as, I argue, that it's actually a form of secularized Christology. Then I'm then wanting to emphasize Christ as incarnate wisdom, and then deep incarnation, Christ the form of beauty, and so on. So just to give you a flavor of where it goes, That's where I've ended up, looking at not just the atonement, but also the resurrection and the new community.